This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is National Public Radio's religion correspondent, Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's with us today to talk about what scientists are learning about spirituality, as well as her personal exploration of spirituality. Some years ago, while working on a story for the Los Angeles Times about fast-growing churches, Barbara Haggerty had an experience that she says lasted just a few moments, but reoriented her life. It led her to keep asking this question, is there more? And it set her on course to report and write her book, Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality. Haggerty says the book is about, in her words, the existence of God. She says, after talking to countless scientists, she has concluded that science cannot prove God, but science is entirely consistent with God. Listeners, feel free to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality is published by Riverhead Books. You'll find our guest online at www.barbarahaggerty.com. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Barbara, welcome. It's good to talk with you.
Oh, Celeste, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Science, you conclude, cannot prove or disprove God, but it's entirely consistent with God. Might science, then, as your title suggests, show us the fingerprints of God?
Yes, that's really what I found, that science cannot have direct proof of God, but we can look for scientific evidence of God. And you look for that kind of evidence in the working of the brains, for example, our brains, which seem to show, scientists believe, that when people, say, pray or meditate deeply, that something happens in their brain that changes. They've done research on long-term meditators, Buddhist monks and Franciscan nuns and others. And they find that there's actually a change in the brain. You can look at prayer and see that that when one prays for oneself, one's body changes. It's called psychoneuroimmunology. And these are the kinds of things that I looked at when trying to discover the answer to the question, as you put it, you know, is there more? Is there more than this? And I think that science does point to circumstantial evidence of God.
Hmm. And tell us a little bit about this idea that science is entirely consistent with God. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that people, let's think of the science of spirituality kind of as someone eating an apple pie, okay? When you eat a piece of apple pie, as you bring the fork up to your mouth, the parts of your brain that mediate, say, smell are activated. The parts of the brain that mediate memory are activated, as you remember the last time that you had a piece of apple pie. Now, two scientists can look at that and say, okay, come to opposite conclusions. One can say, you know what? There is brain chemistry going on, and there is nothing more than brain chemistry going on. There is no apple pie. Another person could look at it and say, you know what? The brain chemistry is a reflection of this other reality called the apple pie. Now, this is kind of a funny analogy, but when you put it in the context of God, one scientist can look at the brain chemistry that occurs when someone prays, for example, and say, you know, it is just brain chemistry. There is no external God that this person is communicating with. Another person, another scientist can say that that brain chemistry reflects a divine connection, an encounter with the divine. And so what I kind of mean is that science is a little bit agnostic about it, about this notion that there is a God. But you can make a case that science points to God.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about the experience you had on that summer evening back in 1995 that reoriented your life.
Yes, I was doing, as you mentioned, a story for the LA Times Sunday Magazine, and it was about why some churches grow and others don't. And I was at a church that you now have heard of, but back then you might not have. This was about 14 years ago, called Saddleback Church, Rick Warren's church. And I was interviewing a woman named Kathy Young. I was interviewing her about her faith and her spiritual journey, and we were sitting outside. It was nighttime. We were sitting under a streetlight, and we were kind of in the middle of this circle of light. And she began talking to me about how she had melanoma, and the melanoma had returned, but that she didn't see that this disease as an attempt by God to kill her, but to give her a transcendent purpose. It was a really, really powerful statement that she was making. And as she talked about her relationship with God, as we were sitting there, I suddenly felt the atmosphere change. It was as if someone stood inside the circle of light and began to breathe on us, as if the air grew warm and moist, as if someone were there. And I have to tell you, Celeste, I was pretty spooked by that. And so I shut down the interview rather quickly, drove back to Los Angeles. But I could not shake this question, which was, what happened? Was I crazy? Was that brain chemistry? Or is there, in fact, perhaps a God, a divine reality that breathed on us, essentially? And it took me another, decade to begin doing the research to try to answer that question, but it was the driving question and probably the driving moment that made me attempt to answer the question, is there more than this?
Mm. Do many people have moments like the one you had speaking with Kathy Young?
Absolutely. That was one really astonishing thing. I mean, we've all heard the surveys that show that 90% of Americans believe in God, or, 87%, around that amount. But there are other studies by the National Opinion Research Center out of the University of Chicago that show that 51% of people have had a transformative, transcendent moment that absolutely changed their view of reality, that they can go back and circle on the calendar and say, yep, June 14th, 2002, that is when I met God, and that is when my worldview changed. And so it's really quite a lot of people who have had this experience, which is, I think, one reason why scientists are finally getting around to studying it. Because, for much of the 20th century, scientists have said, you can't study God, you can't study spiritual experience because it's by definition outside of the tools of science to measure. But some scientists are saying this is such a common human phenomenon that we have to take a look at it. We have to study it in the best way we can. And now we have the instruments to, brain scanners and things like that, so that we can actually begin to do the kind of research that gets at the question.
Yeah. Tell us about Sophie Burnham and her mystical experiences, because this raises the question, it's like, oh my Lord, do you want to have such an experience?
That was precisely my sentiment when I heard it. Sophie Burnham is a woman in Washington, D.C., who was a journalist. I mean, I really related to her. She still is a journalist of sorts. She writes books now. But she was married to a New York Times journalist, and she was a journalist herself. And she went off to do a freelance article down at in South America. And she went to the terraces at Machu Picchu. And while she was there, she was feeling kind of like there was some urgency, this spiritual moment, tsunami was coming upon her. And she'd been really looking for God in many ways, through Buddhism and Hinduism and Christianity. But what happened while she was there is suddenly she was overpowered by this spiritual moment when she felt, she literally had to lie down and she felt at one with the universe, this powerful light and this voice talking to her. And she lay there, absolutely paralyzed, for almost an hour, feeling this sense of eternity and God wash over her. She got up. She realized she was about to miss a bus to go back to her hotel. She ran back, and she, from that moment, felt absolutely different. Her whole worldview changed. Well, the hard part of the story is she came back and she could no longer relate to people in the way that she used to. She ended up getting a divorce. She loves her husband still, but her values and his were different. God became the most important thing in her life. At one point, her husband said to her, "How can I compete with God?" And she said to him, "You can't." And what happened is she really began living a different sort of life. She lives alone now. She's lovely. I met with her a couple of weeks ago. We had coffee. But her whole orientation now is towards spiritual things. That's what she writes about. That's what she thinks about. And I have to say that when talking to people, especially women, almost everyone I met who had had a dramatic spiritual experience, either spontaneous or a near-death experience, had ended up getting divorced. I mean, isn't that it makes you wonder, do you want to do this?
Yeah.
Do you want to have this experience? But it so reoriented them that their lives no longer fit into their old mold.
Yeah. Well, your life was reoriented as well, but not quite to that extent.
That's right.
How did your reorientation affect your relationships with others?
You know, I did have a period where I really had to think about how I wanted to spend my time, whom I wanted to spend my time with. Happily, I have wonderful friends and wonderful family. And there was kind of a period of a couple of years where I was really trying to figure out what I believed. And, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what I believe. But, and I think my family was very patient with me. I spent a lot more time alone. I left Christian Science. I mean, I'd already kind of left Christian Science anyway, but I went into a more kind of mainstream type of Christianity. And, I got a whole lot of new friends who were very interested in spiritual things just as I was. But I also maintained my old relationships as well, I have to say. And I think maybe that was because, A, I didn't want to lose those old relationships, and B, you know, my spiritual experience was like a little stick of dynamite compared to Sophie Burnham's nuclear explosion, you know, so I was able to cope with it a little bit better.
Yeah. One of the things that she told you that I think was very interesting, she said, the experience is not important.
That's right.
She said, it changes you I can't remember if she...
She said a cellular level.
I was going to say biological way.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I heard that over and over again, that people literally felt changed at cellular level, that they felt they were different people, they thought differently, they responded differently. There's a psychologist out in the University of New Mexico named William Miller, and he wrote a book called Quantum Change. And what he did is he studied people who had these sudden, dramatic, transformative moments. And they testified to the same thing, that they felt different in every aspect of their life. And one of the ways that they felt different is they felt not just in the moment of their spiritual experience, but even afterwards, they felt kind of at one with the universe, at one with other people, a connection with other people and nature in a way that they had never felt. It was as if there was this kind of biological change in them. And so I heard this over and over again, this notion of a cellular change in one's feeling and thinking.
Hmm. Would a neurologist, would a neurochemist agree with Sophie that she had been changed on a cellular level?
You know, that's kind of the $64,000 question. The trouble with spiritual experiences is they're kind of slippery little devils, you know. You never know when one is going to come upon you. And so you don't know that Sophie Burnham in June of 1990 is going to have a spiritual experience. So you don't put her in the brain scanner ahead of time and see how her neural connections have changed. See, that's the problem. You can't do that. It's hard to know whether someone has changed. Although, there is really interesting research that is looking at the brain, how people's brains change when they meditate. This research is just very, very nascent. But at the University of Wisconsin, a fellow named Richard Davidson there has looked at people, given them MRIs and EEGs, and then put them on a kind of 2-month or even 2-week training course of meditation every day, Buddhist meditation. And what he finds is that their brain activity does, in fact, change a little bit. Also, what changes is that their immune system is boosted, that people who meditated actually were able to fight off flu virus better than the control group that did not meditate during that same period of time. And so what they are beginning to see is that the brain does, in fact, change. What we don't know is whether the people who gravitate toward things like meditation and prayer and spiritual experience, whether they're already a little bit different to start with. Mm. It's kind of like Tiger Woods. He's a great, you know, practice made him a great golfer, but he was also, you can bet, genetically a very, you know, genetically wired to be a very good athlete. So there's probably both going on here, that people can change their brains, but the people who are most likely to do the hard work to change your brain are oriented that way already, biologically, genetically.
Hmm. Well, we know for certain that the brain is quite elastic and that it can change with experience.
That's right. That's right. I mean, any dramatic experience, no matter what. I mean, if you are bitten by a dog when you're 5 years old, your brain changes to incorporate that into your worldview. And so when you see a dog 20 years later, your brain will do different things than, say, my brain would, because I've never been bitten by a dog. And so we know that any experience, especially one that's longer than, say, 30 minutes, any dramatic emotional experience will change your brain. And it's called neuroplasticity. And now what scientists are trying to do is see if spiritual practices can make dramatic changes in your brain as well, and they're finding that they can.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, National Public Radio's religion correspondent, Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She is the author of Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Barbara Haggerty's honors include a Templeton Cambridge Journalism Fellowship in Science and Religion and a Knight Fellowship at Yale Law School. Before joining NPR, she was a reporter at the Christian Science Monitor. Her book, Fingerprints of God, is published by Riverhead Books. You'll find our guest online at www.BarbaraHaggerty.com. Feel free to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Are there biological or environmental triggers for spiritual experiences?
That is a really great question, and it's one that I looked at a little bit. I think there are, and what I think the largest trigger to spiritual experience is something I call brokenness. This is not original with me. William Miller, the professor at the University of New Mexico who studied quantum change, also found that. And also, you know, you hear this in churches a lot, that when people are broken, they come to God. What I've found is that that the people I talked to said that often they were in a hard place. Maybe they were getting a divorce. I don't know. Maybe they'd been laid off. Maybe they just had angst about the world. But they essentially got to the end of their rope and they let go. They surrendered. And they found that someone caught them, this, whether you want to call it God or a spiritual being or whatever it is, but they felt that when they let go, when they surrendered, they were able to actually incorporate this spiritual experience. You know, this is very, very common in Alcoholics Anonymous. I talked to a woman out in Arizona who had a bad drug addiction and alcohol addiction problem. And one day, when she was out grocery shopping with her husband, and they had two kids, she realized that she and her husband had spent all their money on drugs. And they had no money for the groceries. And she said she went home that day, that night, without the groceries, and she put her head against the cold sink, the countertop next to the sink. And suddenly, she was utterly despairing, but suddenly she felt this kind of electricity go up her spine, and she realized, I'm not going to let this beat me. And she had this sense of kind of a spiritual, almost kind of a spiritual jolt. And you hear about this, but for her it was physiological, which was so interesting. And that moment of surrender turned her around. You hear this over and over and over in Alcoholics Anonymous, that when they finally give up to the higher power or whatever, that they begin this spiritual life, this spiritual transformation. It's one of the 12 steps that you'll have a transformation. Now, doctors believe, scientists believe, that there is a physiological component to this too, that when you're under a lot of stress, basically your body so wears down that when you release it, there are triggers in the body that release endorphins and other things that make you feel better. And so there may be a physiological component to this surrender and brokenness, but that there's a lot more research to be done in that. But what I found is that brokenness and surrender tended to be the triggers to spiritual experience.
Mm. One kind of wonders about that in such a situation where you're at the bottom, you're broken, that this could offer such relief to you that it provides a way to go on and survive.
Yes, and that's what you hear. That's what you hear from alcoholics, and that's what I heard from people over and over again, that they were despairing, and suddenly they had a new lease on life, that they felt that there was a purpose and meaning to their life that they hadn't felt before. And, you know, the spiritual experience only lasts a few seconds or a few minutes. Sophie Burnham's case of a half an hour or an hour was quite long. But that sense of meaning and purpose often lasts with people. And so they're able to continue with a different worldview, mm-hmm. you know, with a different worldview, thinking that I have a purpose and the purpose is to serve others. You know, it's really interesting. Actually, let me tell you one really interesting thing that I found in my work. And this, again, came from looking at people who have had these quantum changes. People's values changed utterly. There were surveys done of people before and people after the spiritual experience, but they were asked to go back and list their five top values before the experience and then after the experience. And listen to what men said. Before the encounter with the divine, their top priorities in this order were wealth, adventure, achievement, pleasure, and being respected. After the spiritual experience, their top priorities in this order were spirituality, personal peace, family, God's will, and honesty. I mean, it was a complete shift in worldview. And that's what I heard over and over and over again, Celeste.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you said early in the book, transforming insights usually come in small moments and pedestrian crises. Why do you suppose that's the case?
You know, that's how it was with me. When I was talking about, I mean, clearly some people have dramatic spiritual experiences, but I think that the small, at least in my own experience, the small insights happen almost organically, that it's like you reach a tipping point. For me, deciding to do this book was, there was a small insight. I was lost in the woods in the Smoky Mountains for, about 5 or 6 hours at night. I had gone hiking and I got lost and I couldn't get out of the mountains. And in that time, I realized that the only way I could get back to civilization, so to speak, was to essentially swim across a rushing river at about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. And I was scared. It took me a while to get up the courage to do it. But after I did it, I felt euphoric. I felt like I had lived because I had taken a risk, one I had to take, but I had taken a risk and I had done something that I didn't believe that I was capable of doing. And that actually was the moment I decided to write the book. I'd been thinking about these questions for years, but after crossing that river, you know, and sitting there drenched on an April evening or something like that, March 6th it was, I realized that I felt like by taking this risk, I was alive again. And I thought, you know, what are the driving questions in my life? It's, is there a God? Is there more than this? I need to take a risk. I need to cross this river. And that was my small insight, that I needed to do this thing. And I did it. And on the other side, Celeste, what I found were, you know, all these scientists who had taken the risk ahead of me, who were beginning to look at spiritual experience, often at the risk of their own careers or the respect of their colleagues. And so that was a small insight insight that launched me into kind of a large spiritual journey.
Yeah. We've got a couple of listeners who would like to join us this afternoon, so let's take a call. A listener in Terre Haute, Indiana, line four. Hi.
Hello. Noam Chomsky was once asked if he believed in God, and being a linguist, he answered that question with a question. What do you mean by God? And so I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
That's such a good question. I have to say that my view of God has actually changed somewhat. Not completely, but it's changed somewhat. When I think about God, I think about God in two ways. One is the God that I can defend through, if I were having, you know, a conversation with a scientist. It's the God that Einstein talked about, an infinite intelligence that stitches together the universe, that creates our, you know, our brains. Freeman Dyson, a physicist, talked about the finely tuned universe that had to be orchestrated, designed by a creator, an infinite mind. He said, it's as if the universe knew we were coming, that all life, all of the universe was geared toward life. Okay, so there is one type of God. That's a God I can defend, a God of intelligence and power who created us and created the universe, because we are such extraordinary beings, you know, we're so remarkable. That's one kind of God. I mean, the other kind of God. Oh, and let me just say, when I talk to people about what they meant by God, people who had spontaneous spiritual experiences, across the board, they talked about the same type of God. Whether you're a Sufi or, you know, a Muslim or a Catholic or Protestant or Buddhist or whatever, they talked about light and love and power and omniscience and a sense of feeling at one with the universe. That's the kind of God that they talked about. I also have another kind of God that I feel like I can hold in my, in, if I hold infinite intelligence in my left hand, I hold my, this other God in my right hand, which is, you know, a God who helps me navigate the world. And I get that from, I mean, you know, I say freely that I'm a Christian. So I get that kind of God, the blueprint for how I want to live my life in the Bible, you know, and sacrificing for others, serving others, doing the kinds of things that, the kinds of counterintuitive things that the Bible talks about. So I have kind of two sorts of gods, if that's permissible. I have one that's I can defend to a scientist, and another that helps me live my life.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
I'm just curious if in your research you have become familiar with the work of the scientist William Tiller, the reporting of Lynn McTaggart, and or the writings of Joseph Chilton Pierce.
You know, I'm not. Can you just tell me a little bit about those? Maybe I'll be able to at least bring some of my research to bear. Tell me about them.
Well, William Tiller is, or at least he was, he may be retired now, but and he was in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, right.
Other things. But he's was an engineer, professor of engineering and material sciences at Stanford, and has done a great deal of research and writing, sort of looking at you know, what our understanding of reality is, and doing experiments to see how intention can change physical reality.
Yeah.
And he talks a lot about what our role as beings are, and I think it would put another dimension on, you know, how you think about or talk about God. Lynn McTaggart is a journalist who's interviewed many, many scientists and gotten them to speak in ways that, you know, so she could not being a scientist can understand physics and quantum physics and this new way of looking at things called the field, as a way that everything is interconnected with everything else. And Joseph Chilton Pierce, author of first book was Crack in the Cosmic Egg, and more recently, The Biology of Transcendence, and talking about what some people might think of as paranormal experience, or even explaining how, for instance, say Christ could manifest things out of thin air in the supposed miracles in terms of fishes and loaves, other things like that, and how other people have been able to do that, and where that comes from, and why we seem to be limited, what our beliefs limit us in our ability to actually manifest those things ourselves. So I'm wondering, this is like another dimension to the things you seem to be talking about.
Well, in fact, especially when it comes to William Tiller, I've actually looked at that, and if I can talk about some of the most, actually it's the most controversial research that I did. There are a whole series of studies that have been done, and more coming online, that looks at the nature of reality and whether one's intentions, as you said, can affect spiritual or physical reality. One study that I looked at, I actually witnessed, was done out at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California. And what they study, what they did, let me just tell you about the experiment. They believe that one person's intentions can affect another person's body, which, sounds a lot like prayer. Scientists say one person's intentions or prayers cannot affect another person's body. But what IONS is doing is they're doing an experiment in which they look at bonded couples, people who are close. And they put one person in a soundproof room, electromagnetically shielded room, say the wife, and there's a camera pointing at her. And then they put the husband in another room. I watched this happen. And the husband is looking at a computer screen. And most of the time during this half-hour experiment, the computer screen is nothing but snow. But for 10-second intervals, at random times, the image of his wife's face will come on the computer screen. And what they do is they've hooked up the man, the husband and the wife, they're looking at physiological indicators like pulse rate and perspiration on their hand. And what they find is that when the man sees his wife, his physiology jumps. I mean, there's an immediate reaction. The question is, would the wife's physiology change as well? Because what the husband was doing was thinking intentional thoughts about his wife during those 10 seconds. What they found is that within 2 seconds, the wife's physiology mirrored the husband's physiology, meaning what they say is it appears that his thoughts seem to have an effect on her body, even though she is nowhere near. Now, they did this experiment quite a few times. They ran 36 couples through it. The chances of this just happening by chance are 11,000 to 1. In other words, it's just not a fluke. There have been studies done like this all over the world in at least 36 other studies, and they've found basically the same thing. What they look at is whether the theory that they have is that we are somehow entangled. There's a theory called quantum entanglement, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance, that once entangled, once two particles are connected, they act as if they are the same particle. So you change the spin of one and the other changes immediately, even though they're separated by miles and miles. That's the whole notion of non-locality or quantum entanglement. So what the theory is that even though quantum entanglement has only been proved at a subatomic level, is it possible that we are entangled as human beings, because we're all made of subatomic, we're all created from atoms. Is it possible that we're connected with each other and with the universe? And this is really, this echoes what the mystics have said through the years, through the centuries, that they're at one with the universe, at one with God. This is kind of controversial territory. It gets into the paranormal. It gets into, intuition and gut feelings and everything else. But it is an area that is beginning to be researched with NIH dollars, I might add. So it'll be really, really fun to see what happens as this research becomes more mature.
Does a caller want to follow up?
There's certainly a lot of research taking place right now. The whole field of epigenetics shows that our intention, our thoughts, our beliefs even change how our genes express, or certainly influence how our genes express. There's just a lot of different aspects out there, and the very exciting things going on with psychology and energetic psychology now, interacting with the energetic system of the body for very quick changes in terms of negative emotions, things like that. So there's a lot out there.
There is a lot out there. I think it's safe to say that it's just beginning, too, or it's just beginning to get some credence. Before, you know, all of this stuff was put off as in the ghetto called parapsychology. But now NIH money is going toward studies at places like the Cleveland Clinic and other places where they're actually studying at least the effect of one person's thoughts on another person's body. The other areas I'd have to look at more closely, but I know that this is a really, really exciting time to be a scientist, if you're brave enough to look at these things.
And also a religion reporter, huh?
It was a lot of fun. I must say it was probably the most interesting year of my life is when I took my year off from NPR. I mean, I love NPR, you know, all of that. But this year of studying these very basic questions and talking to these scientists who are really pioneering the nature of reality, I mean, I can't tell you how much fun it was.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hello. I kind of disagree with everything you said. I think Carl Sagan said it best, you know, just save yourself a step and accept that you don't understand anything, you know. People are always trying to make sense of stuff that doesn't make sense, you know. And like he said, that we created God to kind of fill in all this that we don't know, but, you know, who created him? You know, it doesn't make any sense, you know. Just accept that we don't know and move on.
Well, no, that's and you know, a lot of people feel that way, and a lot of scientists feel that way, that this is really a silly endeavor that's going to end up in a dead end, and I respect those people, and you know, as I said, I have no idea whether there is a God or not. I like to believe there is. I think I'm validated in looking at the science and saying, hey, I see circumstantial evidence of God. But a lot of people don't. You know, I think of the science of spirituality as kind of a Rorschach test that you bring to it your worldview. And so, you know, one person can look at all of this evidence and say it's you know, it's nothing. It's a bunch of squiggles. And another person can look at this and say, no, this is evidence of God. And what I've found over and over again is, especially in talking to scientists, the ones who believe we're onto something here, you know, they're onto something here in this search for the science of spirituality, they came to their science open-minded about that. Actually, that's a pejorative way to put it. They came to this science thinking that, yeah, there may in fact be a God. And the ones who didn't believe that there's a God or there's anything more than this came to their science, came to the evidence, believing that in advance. And so all I'm saying is that, you know, our worldview has a lot to do with how we interpret the evidence. And I think it is just as valid to have your worldview, your view that, you know, we don't know, there's probably nothing there, and, you know, and move on. It's just as valid to have that worldview as there is to have the worldview that says this is worth exploring. So I'm really glad that you called and brought that perspective.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Do you want to follow up?
No, that's okay. I said my piece.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. I'm glad you called as well. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's the religion correspondent for NPR, and she is the author of Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left in this portion of the program. More time for calls, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Tell us the story, please, of Francis Collins and Dean Hamer.
Two NIH scientists, both of them brilliant, both geneticists, and Dean Hamer tried to believe that he wanted to find what he called the God gene. And so he did a study. He got a lot of DNA samples from a lot of different people, and some people describe themselves as very spiritual, and other people describe themselves as not so spiritual. And what he tried to see is what was the difference in their genes, how their genes genes expressed. And he located what he considered to be the God gene. It's called VMAT2. He said, you know, some people have the kind of the chocolate variation of the gene and some have the vanilla variation of the gene. And whichever variation you have, you'll either be spiritual or not. Well, Francis Collins took issue with that. Francis was the head of the Human Genome Project. He basically mapped the human genome at NIH. And he said, you know, this gene, this VMAT2 gene, accounts for 0.5% of the variation in spirituality among people. This is not the God gene. However, what I would say, and I think they'd both agree with me, is that there are genetic components to spirituality. I mean, my mother is very spiritual, and I'm spiritual. You look at twin studies, and you find, especially when you look at identical twins who are separated at birth, you find that some, you know, that the twins, even if they're raised in different environments, might be both very spiritual, even though their families that they're living with are not. And so I think what we are going to be able to, well, I shouldn't say, scientists believe that we may be able to find a cluster of genes, that there's a genetic component, like there is with so many other personality traits, or with depression or schizophrenia, that we will be able to identify certain genes which incline a person towards spirituality or not.
Hmm. Early in the conversation, you mentioned people that had near-death experiences. What can these tell us? Can they tell us anything about the possible existence of God or an afterlife?
You know, that they really can't tell us whether there is an afterlife. People have the same experience going through the light, going through the tunnel to the light, seeing dead relatives, sometimes seeing a spiritual being, that kind of thing, feeling light and love and all of that. But we really can't know whether that means that their brains are just dying and this is what a brain does in the throes of dying when it's gasping for breath, or whether that's a reality. But here's what's interesting. Scientists have also looked at people who are dying, who have out-of-body experiences, and who are able to, for example, one woman I interviewed was able to see an entire or much of an operation while she was under anesthesia with her eyes taped shut and her ears plugged up with clickers that were clicking at 90 decibels so loud that she couldn't hear a conversation. Yet she was able to recount conversations, describe the operating room, describe the Midas Rex bone saw that was used to cut open her head. She saw herself being resuscitated. Now, how do you explain this? And there are material ways to explain it, although I, to tell you the truth, in that case, found them unconvincing. But what this suggests is maybe not that there's life after death, but is it possible that a person's consciousness or a person's mind can continue to operate even when the brain is not functioning correctly or maybe not functioning at all? And this is actually a raging question in science. This is not just in near-death experiences. It's a big question. And this is an area that I find almost the most interesting of all, that can our consciousness survive death? There's got to be a lot of research done on this, but it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call before we're out of time. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi. Line one, there we go.
My request is, can you define spirituality as you're using it?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of like the God question. When I think of spirituality, I don't think in terms of denomination. What I think of is spiritual experience. And there you see a commonality across denominations, across religions, across, you know, people who were spiritual but not religious. People who are atheists described, and weren't atheists after the experience, described the same sort of experience that the Franciscan nun or the Buddhist monk or the Sufi or the Catholic described when they had their dramatic experience. And it was a sense of, it was often an out-of-body experience. It was a sense of overpowering love and light, a sense that all was right, all would be well, a sense of confidence that that there was life after death. That was another thing that you heard a lot. So when I look at spiritual experience, I don't look at, you know, the doctrines of Christianity or the doctrines of Judaism. I kind of go one level up and look at what people feel as they encounter what they consider to be the divine.
Hmm. Listener, want to follow up?
Only to say that I'm an atheist myself, and also have had important spiritual experiences of the sort that you've been describing.
But it didn't change you.
Oh, it did change me very much.
But it didn't convince you that there is a spiritual reality.
Correct.
So how did you incorporate that? What did you think happened to you?
Was certainly a profound experience. Primarily, I experienced it as an increased awareness of connectedness with myself, with everything, and everything with everything.
That's fascinating. Yeah, that is something I heard as well. And so you can believe in the connectedness, and you can believe in that without having a God. Quantum entanglement would suggest that as well.
Yeah.
So you can believe in a connectedness without believing in God.
Right, and I don't think it's necessary to believe in connectedness. As I see it, it's an observation.
Right. No, that's fascinating. The atheists, the people I talked to, probably were self-selected. If they were talking to me, they believed in a spiritual reality, and I did talk to people who went from atheism to believing in that. But as I said, they were probably self-selected, and that's why they ended up talking to me and getting in touch with me, or that's why I heard about them. So that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing your experience.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. One last question before we have to wrap up here. I have so many others, but just one more. One neurologist you spoke with said spirituality could be a goal. So is it something we can all work on if that's what we want to do?
Absolutely, and that gets to the issue of neuroplasticity, that if we decide that this is important to us, we will find spiritual practices to essentially change our brain, to be able to access the divine more easily. I mean, if you believe in a divine. And so that's what spiritual practices are all about, and that's what they've been about through the centuries. Meditation, prayer, fasting, even, chanting, things like that. And so spirituality is a goal that is achievable, and it's achievable through practice. Now, some people are probably going to be spiritual virtuosos, just as, some people are going to, Tiger Woods is probably unique, but everyone can achieve spiritual experience and a connectedness, if you believe in the divine, a connectedness with the divine.
There we have to leave it, right out of time. Barbara, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was great fun. Thank you, Celeste.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She is the religion correspondent for National Public Radio, and she's the author of Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality. The publisher is Riverhead.